tell you right now that the new rooms will be completely air conditioned. And we hope to have them in operation by summer, but of course we can't meet these little spells of unexpected weather. This evening, we are going to begin a series of studies of mysticism. And in harmony with our general program, we want to try to present the material in accordance with a graduate level of basic thinking, hoping to clarify the terms, but not to remove any of the essential information which the thoughtful person should have. The term mysticism, we all rather well know. We know approximately the meaning which is classically associated with it, namely that it represents a belief or a conviction that the experience of the divine being or the divine essence is possible to man without the intervention of organized theology. It would move religion from tradition and authority directly to the substance of experience. Therefore, essentially, the classical writers on mysticism refer to it as a rational process. As such, it is recorded in the works of Immanuel Kant, René Descartes, and many other philosophers, including Spinoza, who have been accused of being mystics. The word has come into such general and broad usage, however, that the essential principles of mysticism have been for the most part obscured. We have placed so much emphasis upon the hope or belief that we are capable of certain metaphysical experiences by means of which spiritual truths may be brought more strongly to our conviction, that we have overlooked the fact that this is not essentially mysticism. Mysticism does not exist rationally upon a theoretical level. It is not a process of trial and error. It is not a program of experimentation and research. Nor does it have as its primary purpose the development of an interior phenomena of any kind. Mysticism, in its original and classical meaning, was associated primarily with the idea that a certain way of life produced a certain result, and that this result is sought apart from the natural causes by which it might be induced, or if it was brought about by any artificial intellection, could not properly be termed mysticism. Through the early centuries of the Christian Church and among the religions of both the Far East and the Near East, mysticism was therefore closely associated with asceticism. In other words, the mystic was required to practice a certain way of life. To aspire to mystical apprehension, the person must therefore achieve a grand and complete renovation of himself. This phase of the subject lost more and more interest with the coming of the Protestant Reformation. And as early as the time of Luther, mysticism had already divided into that group which clung desperately to the high ethical and moral levels of mystical thought, as represented in the writings of the pseudo-Dionysus, and what might be termed a practical mysticism, in which the primary problem was the attainment of end, regardless of means. This latter school, therefore, became definitely concerned with the possibility of the production of mystical phenomena by the inducing of artificial states of consciousness within the individual, in order that he might record or report certain borderline phenomena, or might experience certain exaltation or a sense of interior liberation, or again find an exaggeration or intensification of his sensory faculties, his imagination, and even his attitudes of reverence or veneration. A modern example of this particular situation is the increasing scientific interest in the various products and byproducts of the cactus plant, mescal. This plant, which was known to the Aztecs of the Valley of Mexico and also spread through the northern parts of Mexico and the southern parts of the United States under the general name of peyote or peyote, has caused numbers of modern psychologists and psychological investigators to consider the possibility of recording artificially produced mystical experiences induced by the use of the various mescal alkaloids. This concept has certain scientific advantages, inasmuch as enough information has already been assembled to indicate that by one way, means or way or another, certain faculties can be stimulated. Certain processes and functions resembling those of psychoanalytical procedure can be induced, and in a certain number of cases, therapy has resulted. The danger of this type of experimentation, however, lies in its essential departure from the essence of mysticism, and as has been pointed out by a number of the early mystics, and has been again very clearly emphasized by William James. It is a thin line indeed between mystical experience and hallucination, imagination, or the various stimulations by artificial means of emotional faculties within the individual. And it is extremely difficult, even at this time, to distinguish between pure mysticism and a pseudo kind of mysticism, in which certain phenomenal factors are present, but in which the proper condition or situation where genuine mysticism is not present. Thus, we are interested this evening in attempting to understand something of the use of mysticism in the practical daily living of the individual. And we must first of all, therefore, outline certain guards, protections, certain means of analysis, certain personal defense instruments by which the individual can come to estimate the merit or demerit, the validity or the non-validity of the personal experiences that may occur to himself. All experience of a mystical likeness is not true mysticism. And there is scarcely a day go by in which problems are brought to me in which various forms of pseudo-mystical phenomena are reported. These experiences cannot, however, rise from true mystical apprehension. They must arise from certain psychological situations which have come into focus within the subconscious life of the person. Thus, we come back to our original concept as taught in the East by Buddha and in the West by Plotinus, namely, that mysticism has to be an effect, the cause of which must be equal to the effect produced. The cause of mysticism is neither simply well-wishing or the scientific stimulation of extrasensory faculties. The cause of mysticism is a certain adjustment of human consciousness with the laws of universal existence. Thus, all true mysticism begins as a way of life. It begins as a dedication, and it unfolds according to the conduct pattern of the individual. Mysticism cannot arise in a situation contrary to itself. This does not mean that extrasensory perceptions of various kinds, as for example those resulting from the use of the mescal button, that such experiences cannot prove an attractive mystery. We do not deny that the individual, without the improvement of his moral or cultural life, can, under certain conditions, have experiences which transcend his ordinary functions. The question then arises, how valid are these experiences? How important are they to the individual? And do they actually advance any useful purpose in his life? Authorities researching into this problem have come to the rather sober and, I think, sincere and reasonable conviction that pseudo-mysticism has produced very little good. For the small amount of encouragement or stimulation which arises from it, there is a group of dangers which cannot be overestimated. The individual, under hallucination of any kind, is not approaching truth naturally and properly. And even though this hallucination may gratify him, may cause him to feel that he has attained a deep degree of insight, if this insight is not real, even though it may appear enjoyable or even instructive, if it is not real, it is unreal. And if it is unreal, it endangers the solid growth of the person. We have observed, therefore, that nearly all individuals becoming overly concerned with phenomena of any kind impair their own progress and arrive ultimately at a disquietude or a series of interior conflicts that may be considered essentially dangerous. A problem was brought to my attention by a letter which I only received when I returned from this last trip, in which experiments were made to discover, if possible, the relationship between experimentation in psychic phenomena and the deterioration of bone marrow. Now, this seems like a rather complicated situation. We are not sure what is going to arise from this program of research, whether we shall discover that the premature and ill-advised effort to stimulate psychic faculties may have a serious effect upon the entire energy economy of the human body. Whether this be demonstrated or not, the principle in terms of psychology, philosophy, and religion has been well justified and demonstrated. Namely, that there is nothing more dangerous to the normal growth of man than hallucination, inasmuch as hallucination represents a kind of experience. The individual prone to give greater weight to that which happens to himself is more easily deceived by himself than by any other person. And if this deceit advances some cause or belief, in which he is interested or concerned, or gratifies some natural or unnatural ambition within himself, it is more likely that he will become the victim of self-delusion. Thus, mysticism's greatest hazard is an artificial facsimile of itself, a situation which resembles it in many respects, but is not it. And this hallucination is not limited merely to persons of comparatively slight information, but is traceable in some of the outstanding documents relating to the field. It is therefore quite certain that we must ultimately divide mysticism into another grouping of two parts or appearances, the first being genuine mysticism and the second psychological mysticism. James was one of the first to point out the importance of pseudo-mysticism as a psychological symptom, to point out that very often what we call mystical experience may be merely the pressure of psychological symbolism, which can arise as a series of interior manifestations or delusions, just as surely as it can induce dreams, nightmares, and other apparently mysterious sleep phenomena. So in our mysticism, we have only one true and proper guidance, namely that mysticism represents a natural growth. It must therefore be revealed through a more or less complete integration of the person on a level of mystical insight. Such integration calls for a gradual reformation or reorganization of the major perspective toward life. We observe that in our modern way of living, the attitude of the individual becomes more and more evasive on all matters relating to the changing of personal conduct. He is convinced today that he can attain certain powers regardless of what he is, and that therefore there are tricks, scientific formulas, even drugs, or hypnosis, or some particular and special way to attain an extension of faculty apart from an actual merit system. This optimism is ill-grounded. It is not possible. And wherever there appears to be an exception, that exception will ultimately prove the rule, because the exception will inevitably lead to a sorry chain of consequences which the individual must ultimately face. Now, it is not assumed that modern man in his modern environment and under the pressures of modern living can or should turn from the daily responsibilities which make up his existence to some solitary asceticism, or to renounce his proper and reasonable duties in order to cultivate certain extrasensory faculties within his own nature. In fact, the effort actually to cultivate by intent may itself destroy the validity of the entire experiment. For all practical purposes, therefore, mysticism, like every other form of unfoldment in nature, is a natural and gradual procedure, cultivated without special tension or stress or strain, not longed for or yearned after, but rather assumed to be a natural state or stage in the development of normal persons in the course of the integration of themselves. Mysticism is therefore as natural in the evolutionary development of man as any other stage of consciousness through which he may pass. It is only when it is natural, arising as the inevitable consequence of adequate causes, that it can be regarded as true and can be regarded as completely safe. Because of this, and because most persons of devout and sincere minds have certain convictions, and these convictions impel toward the basic concept underlying mysticism, namely that man is capable of an interior apprehension or apperception of reality. Because we hold this to be a sacred truth in our own lives, we should and can begin the gradual development of mystical value. We can do this safely, so long as we remain essentially modest creatures, as long as we refrain from exaggerating our own attainments or ignoring our own faults. The beginning of practical mysticism is therefore honesty. And it is honesty, in this sense of the word, that brings us very close to the realm of science. Scientists may or may not be honest, but science is essentially honest. Science represents an acceptance of a pattern of exactitudes, that everything in nature is orderly, reasonable, factual, that all things that appear to be mysterious are so only because some phase of this pattern is unknown or has been incorrectly interpreted. Assuming, therefore, the factuality of the basic scientific concept, the premise behind science, namely that everything is as it is. And on this basis, beginning the estimation of ourselves, we may come to some useful conclusions. The individual is not better than he is. He is not worse than he is. He is not more nor less than he is. He has not outgrown more than he has outgrown. And he has outgrown all that he has outgrown. And somewhere in this series of almost platitudinous statements, which seem so obvious that it almost offends the intellect to put them into words, there is one tremendous and important fact, a fact that was summarized beautifully for me by an old Southern mammy who once said to one of my cousins when I was a small boy, "There's no use trying to be what you ain't, because you is what you am." And never was greater word spoken by Plato, Aristotle, or Buddha. And our entire life, in terms of personal growth, depends upon the solid recognition of this fact. We are what we are. In addition to what we are, there are two polarities, the sharp and the flat, of this natural tone. One is the positive pole. We can be what we hope to be. The other is the negative pole, so to say. And this is to the effect that we do not have to remain the undesirable part of what we are. We are in constant motion and growth. A man today, oriented in a very complicated world, can take very basic advantage of certain of the essential concepts of science. He can recognize a complete fact, the fact of things, and that the only way that things can change is factually. And we use the term sometimes actually.
And by actually, we actually mean by action. Therefore, all things which because of action are what they are can only be changed by another action. An action either toward what they should be, or if we are not so positively inclined, an action away from what they should be. Now, it would not seem reasonable to assume that mysticism stands upon so solid and normal a footing as this simple statement of factuality. Yet this is the solid ground of the entire subject. The individual, being what he is, has a faculty range which is determined by what he is. This faculty range is not primarily determined by his artificially attained education. Education may modify the fact of the individual, but only under one condition, namely that education leads to action, by means of which an existing fact is modified or changed by a new quality of action. It would follow inevitably from this that the person being what he is, his faculties, his powers, and his propensities constitute instruments. By means of these instruments, he bridges intervals between himself and what he knows, and all other things beside himself and what he desires to know. In order to create substantial bridges by which he can extend himself reasonably and properly, these bridges have to be natural. They have to be factual, and they have to be secure rationally and psychologically. To build such bridges is a slow and not especially spectacular undertaking. Yet it is this type of undertaking, systematically continued and constantly and dedicatedly advanced, which leads ultimately to new levels of sensory unfoldment. We think sometimes of the extrasensory gamuts and mystical attainments of primitive people, and we wonder why it is that some Australian bushman or some American Indian medicine priest or perhaps a Fiji Islander can have valid metaphysical experiences and we do not have them. It would seem to indicate to our minds that these experiences are not associated with progress, but are essentially the reward of a primitive or semi-savage condition. This is not the truth, however. Psychologically, the truth lies in the peculiar and abiding virtue of primitive man, and that is his inevitable clinging to factuality. Primitive man lives so completely in a group of acceptances that he does not intrude complicated psychological intellectualism on his own part. He lives very close to the factualities of life. And because he has not obscured his consciousness with the various artificial factors with which our natural thinking has been afflicted, he is capable of a certain psychic penetration which we no longer possess. We have built barriers of sophistication which must also be overcome. We have ceased to be natural. We have ceased to be simple. And perhaps we have ceased to be humble. And because, therefore, we have developed certain arrogance, certain sophistication, or a certain self-opinionism, we continually lock those procedures by means of which we might open ourselves to true mystical experience. True mystical experience arises out of simple acceptances. A man to become simple again must truly be born again, for he has left essential humility far behind him. To meet this situation and to start where we are now, which is always the problem that confronts the individual, we must realize that as mysticism is not in itself an intellectual action, but is rather in itself an emotional experience. And as man is capable of a wide gamut of emotionality in his living, thinking, and feeling, it becomes evident that in some way his emotions must be brought within areas of realization or understanding, so that emotion can be factualized. The fact of emotion is no less than the fact of reason. But we have come to regard reason as a positive certainty and emotion as an uncertainty. This is simply due to our own perspective on these matters, having little, if anything, to do with the facts themselves. In the use of such drugs as mescal, we have discovered, for example, the tremendous overtones of simple things. We become aware symbolically that the universe as we see it and know it is infinitely more important, more diversified, and more intimately stimulating than we have been likely to imagine. Life to the average person is rather a routine drudgery. It is composed of the continuous repetitions of traditional activities. The person under strong and immediate economic compulsions is forced, therefore, to think of himself as living a material external life, and escaping from this by some violent directive into what he might term a more rarefied superphysical atmosphere of dreams and ideals and hopes and aspirations. Mysticism insists that this rarefied atmosphere is just as near to us as our materialism, that there is really no essential difference, that what appears to be a difference is interpretation, emphasis, or the concentration of our attention upon only certain parts of actions or conditions or circumstances. To begin as a natural mystic, as Thoreau began, as many very quiet mystical thinkers have begun, something in the spirit of Walt Whitman and others who have been greatly admired for a rather simple appreciation of value, we must begin by discovering fact, essential fact, in the commonplace. Science can be of the greatest help to us because it can remind us that most things are stodgy and uninteresting because we do not understand them. You will find, therefore, a person who has very little appreciation of art wander by a beautiful painting or a fine example of sculpture, comparatively untouched and unmoved by it. 10 years later, as the result of interest in art, he comes back to the same piece of work and finds himself enthralled and entranced. In music, it may require 30, 40, or 50 listenings to a great music drama such as Tristan and Isolde before the sheer genius of the music really reaches into us. We cannot immediately grasp these innumerable overtones, these wonderful galandalios, or decorations of life, which are everywhere present if we pause to consider. Confucius and Lao Tse in China both considered mysticism as the opportune pause. They recognized it as resulting from the sudden halting of the superficial pageantry of thought and emotion, and the giving of the attention to meaning. For in meaning lies fact. The most simple thing that we handle every day, the most common conveniences that we know, are tremendous, dramatic things if we give them thought. But if we take these things for granted as merely part of the process of living, we move on and we take education for granted. We take politics for granted. We take philosophy for granted, religion for granted, and ultimately we take God for granted, assuming that an intellectual acceptance constitutes an acceptable affiliation of consciousness. This is not true. That which is taken for granted is never known as fact. And the tendency to move over surfaces without ever penetrating into the substratums of these surfaces, this tendency is so strictly and totally Western, and most of all, so completely contemporary. It is our way of doing things, excused under the broad statement that we have no time. Actually, the individual who superficially employs his opportunities has no time because he has wasted all of it. And to become more thoughtful and more penetrating is of the highest importance. A good example of this would be the day of the average person. He may rise and on his way to work, he may get into his car. Now to him, his automobile is his second self, his alter ego. He practically lives in it, and his home is merely a detour between the front door and the garage. He practically is as attached to his car as the ancient Mexican Indians thought that Cortes was attached to his horse. They were one being, a kind of unicorn. Perhaps man is an automobile human kind of composite being. Yet although he depends upon this automobile and is continuously bewailing the costs of it, is continuously unhappy over the mechanical bills that arise in connection with it, man has never realized or appreciated that most of the essential laws of universal dynamics are locked up in his car. If he understood his car completely, he would understand the universe. It is an ever-present text revealing hundreds of principles working together, brought together. Yet the minds that conceived and united these to form this modern monster of convenience. Actually, these minds were following archetypal laws. And if there is anything in the design of a car or its motor that is not true, that is not factual, the model will be shortly removed from the market, because it will be unsatisfactory in action. Thus we have in this car principles which explain to us many of the deepest problems of biology, many elements of physics, mathematics, chemistry. And we discover how these various parts of knowledge fit together to produce an astonishing utility, one of the outstanding devices created by human ingenuity. yet created only because the inventors, down through time, have been practicing copying fragments of nature. They have found again and again rules and operations naturally occurring, which have given them the key and the guide to the creation of this car. Experiments in aviation have followed the same rules. The airplane, from its most primitive developments to its most advanced period of jet propulsion, is a story of the universe. It is a story of life, of law, of fact, and of the infinite combinations of principles by means of which certain specific and definite ends may be attained. Out of the consideration of such things, including the washing machine, the curling iron, the electric toaster, the woolen fabrics of your clothing, your glasses, your ballpoint pen, paper, silk, rubber, housing, walls, roofs, heating, ventilation. All of these things exist simply because man has been able to combine natural facts. And the reason why one man invents these and another does not is that one man becomes aware of a fact, and in another person this awareness is not equally stimulated. Thus life is continually confronting us with symbolical representations of value, of eternal fact. There is an old Greek-Roman study of ancient sewerage systems based upon the study of the arterial circulation of the human body. So we adapt one fact to another need, and if our adaptation is correct, the new need is satisfactorily met. But if in this adaptation we depart in any way from fact, we shall ultimately regret this departure, whether it by intent or ignorance, and we will correct or reform our device until it once more functions properly because it is factual. This discovery of the imminence of more than we realize is of the greatest validity in giving the individual an understanding of the Paracelsian axiom that those who would understand God must walk the book of nature with their feet. In other words, they must recognize the imminence of eternal doctrine, and they must recognize man's intellect or his consciousness as an unfolding process of acceptances, of discoveries leading to uses, and that what we call inspiration is becoming aware. It is the breathing in of universal reality. To the mystic, the recognition that he lives in a world of reality from which he is divided by his own unreality becomes the inducement for the larger correction of his own nature. It leads him to recognize the tremendous challenge, not of mere observation, but the challenge that comes from the ability to interiorly become aware that he abides in a midst of fact, that morality is to live according to fact, and that morality and ethics are therefore good living because they keep the facts, and that religion essentially is the same thing, inasmuch as the will of God is revealed to man by fact, there being no appeal beyond the will of God. Man has no appeal beyond fact, which is his discovery of the divine procedure, as this procedure works out on levels within his comprehension. It is also inevitable that man should assume that there are other procedures beyond his comprehension, no less factual, and that what we would term this mystical ascent into rarefied atmosphere is really only man's advancement in subtle fact, the exchange of that which is more rare or attenuated for that which is more gross or material or obvious, but never for a moment departing from fact. This great need, then, to be factual is in what way impaired in man? If the absolute fact of life is God living, why is man not immediately and intuitively aware of this? He probably is immediately and intuitively so aware. But this immediate and intuitive reaction is almost immediately blocked by intellection. The individual cannot be content with the acceptance of a fact. He must dramatize it. He must dogmatize it. He must creedalize it. He must in some way reduce it to the nature of imperfection like himself. In so doing, he transforms a natural fact into an unnatural error, and then attempts to live upon his interpretation rather than upon the fact. This is perhaps the reason why, for so many people, what is right and what they want to do become synonymous terms. The individual takes it for granted that what he wants is good. He does not try to adapt himself to any standard of good. He assumes that he possesses this standard and adapts the facts to himself, which means to adapt a reality to an unreality. And this, in turn, destroys the dynamic of the fact, and the person falls into illusion. If we move constantly from a true acceptance of that which is true, we shall observe immediately that a marked change occurs in the pattern of our interior living. This marked change, when viewed in perspective, is extremely alarming. The first alarm comes when it occurs to us that if there is a difference between what we want to do and what we should do, the achievement of virtue arises through the inhibition of our natural desires. Small children arrive at the natural conclusion for them that if it's pleasant, it's wrong. If they like it, they shouldn't do it. And if they are enjoying it immensely, it is approaching the state of mortal sin. The person normally, therefore, divides his life into what he wants to do and what he should do, and regards these as dissimilars. In the light of fact, this is an error to start with. He has no such choice. He has only the choice of accepting the fact or coming under the penalty of illusion. If it were possible for the individual to live without fact and live well, the entire ethical and moral structure of nature would collapse. But it has been demonstrated since the beginning of human intellect that the person cannot do this, regardless of all his optimism and his incessant trying. And, of course, it is obvious that the subject has been given adequate exploration and adequate experimentation. Man has tried every evasion conceivable. He has made every mistake possible. And he has assumed every evasive action or attitude within the gamut of his capacities. And still, he is unable to escape factuality. He is unable to escape the foundation upon which all things must be built. This may seem to be a long digression, but it is not. It is not because it is the foundation of mysticism. Mysticism is the gradual discovery of fact. Each degree of discovery leading naturally to a corrective within the individual. The mystic is simply a person who tries to apply what he knows and also tries to continually increase his knowing in order that he may apply more completely. The end of his search is not that he shall attain knowing, but that by a degree of knowing, he shall attain a factual existence, an existence without alarming error, subterfuge, or deceit, likely to detract from his ultimate integrity. Having this thought basically in his consciousness, the mystic begins by tying experience outward and experience inward into a pattern. The child going to school learns a little of a new lesson every day. Being a child, it is quite probable that these lessons cannot be immediately applied. The child learns, for example, one day the location of the Amazon River. A little later, perhaps, the exports and imports of New York Harbor for 1948. These stimulating and amazing discoveries are more or less wasted on a teenager. In fact, they would, some of them, be wasted on an adult. But they constitute a dawning or growing accumulation of facts. Now, these facts are more or less purely intellectual facts. They may be useful someday. More generally, they simply provide a general orientation. They help the individual to have a certain insight into the way of the world in which he lives, the communities in which he may travel, and the means by which his civilization is perpetuated. These things can ultimately add up to a kind of education about his world. But even more pertinent and valuable is a very interesting little formula that can continually be used. Namely, that each person starting out in the day should try during that day to add one more fact to his life. Now, of course, in the abstract and the absolute, facts are not very numerous. Facts are few, and the great facts sustain all life. But in our common experience, we are not able to assimilate these great facts. Therefore, we must approach them more humbly, observing first those most immediate and available facts. There are only certain facts immediately accessible to us in the common daily experience of living. We cannot suddenly experience Angkor Wat or Bangkok Siam because we're not going there. We can have an intellectual comprehension of the world and its countries, its cities, and its nations. But these are beyond immediate experience in their totality, except in a very few cases. However, there is the possibility of adding a fragment of fact to our way of life every single day we live. These fragments, which are most vital to us, have to do with the values of things. They have to do with decisions that have to be made. They have to do with our use of our means and our time. They have to do with our conduct and our association with other persons. They have to do with our sober reflections about the inadequacies of ourselves under the pressures of emergency. They tell us something of our own limitations and how we follow the admonition of the apostle that when we would do good, evil is ever nigh unto us. But each day we can find a fact of our own weakness. Those are very easy to find if we're diligent. The fact of someone else's strength, that is not quite so easy to find because we do not believe that much in other people. But it is a useful thing to enlarge this belief. The recognition of the relationship between action and reaction in our own private business. Every day we can enlarge our understanding by little flashes of insight. These little flashes of insight are themselves mystical experiences. They are little ones, but all things must begin as little ones. And as Lord Bacon's pointed out, all young things are awkward in their proportions. Therefore, the beginning is not the end, but the entire mystical method is revealed through the first legitimate flash of insight. The first time the individual is truly aware of an unrecognized or previously ignored fact, he has achieved half a step forward. He has put one foot out. Now he must draw the other foot to meet it. The second half of each step is the application of this newly discovered fact to an internal experience within himself.